I'm from Argentina originally, and I went to Argentina at the beginning of December. Essentially, I was going for a vacation and to relax for a month. This obviously didn't turn out as planned. I think before I can get into actually the events that happened over the month I was there and my impressions of it and whatnot, in order to really understand the significance of everything and why it happened, I have to start with a background that needs to start pretty far back with a dictatorship in 1976, because a lot of what happened was triggered by, of course, the debt that Argentina has and the policies of the IMF and World Bank and whatnot. And this debt begins, well, it began before, but it began to become a serious issue with the military dictatorship, which came in March 24th, 1976, essentially to fight a guerrilla war against the insurgencies that Argentina had at the time. This war, the dictatorship lasted from 76 to 83. This war was essentially over by 78. They crushed the guerrillas pretty quickly. But what happened was, being a military dictatorship, they thought it would be a good idea to spend a lot of money on guns and tanks and weapons of all sorts. And this is how a large part of the foreign debt was incurred, buying tanks and things of that sort. In 82, the military dictatorship was starting to crumble a little. This, I think one of the first real evidences of this was, Argentina has a very strong soccer culture. A lot of the popular sentiment goes through the soccer stadiums. And every once in a while at games, the fans would start chanting anti-dictatorship things. Because it was the only time when you could say something like this and not have, 10 soldiers pounce on you and, take you God knows where and do God knows what to you. The dictatorship, sensing this, tried to start a war, as we all know. War, nationalism, and all that, keeps people at bay. At first, they tried to start one with Chile over a piece of land way down south that, nobody really cared about. It was really ridiculous. It was blatant warmongering. There was no other way to put it. This failed, I think, very fortunately, because I think that had we entered into a war with Chile, they probably would have taken over the country. The Argentine military is quite pathetic. But they failed, so they went over to the Falklands, or the Malvinas, or whatever you want to call them, and they decided to start trouble with the British. That it's a touchy issue, the issue of the Falklands. Some people say the Argentine left supports getting the Falklands or the Malvinas back, because their argument is it's not an issue of self-determination, because there was Argentines there, the British came, kicked them out, and put British people there. Whereas the British say, obviously, self-determination, they're British, the UN gives them the right to choose who they want to be a part of, and they want to be part of England. But anyways, we started that war. And what's funny, I was obviously too young to remember it, but I've looked through the newspapers and magazines of the time, and you read them, and it says, we're winning, the English are being routed, we're winning, the English are being routed, we're winning, the English are being routed, we lost, Argentina surrendered, panic. This enraged the Argentine people. They felt very much betrayed, and there was a lot of popular uprisings. The presidential palace was laid siege to, and the dictatorship ended soon after this. This brought the so-called democratic period. The first elected president we had was Alfonsín, a radical. That's the name of the party, not actually a radical. But, these people still haven't been put in jail for the 30,000 Argentines that have disappeared. They granted amnesty to them. But what we had, what brought us to the next issue, was there were some economic plans that were supposed to jumpstart the Argentine economy and, get us rolling again. And it was a horrible failure, and the government just kept pumping out money because there wasn't enough money on the streets, they said. And obviously this led to inflation, which led to hyperinflation. And I remember when I was 5 or 6, 88, 89, I would go to the supermarket and you'd be doing your shopping and they'd say, for example, the bread would be 8,000 ustedes. And 10 minutes later, you'd hear over the loudspeakers, the bread is now 8,500 ustedes. And, you're still going around and 20 minutes later, they'd announce again, the bread is now 9,000 ustedes. So you had to rush through your shopping or your money was just going to disappear. Eventually, of course, this led to looting, much like we saw last month, and the looting led to Alfonsín's resigning before the end of his term, and there was again elections, and Menem was ushered in. Menem was from the Peronist Party, and he promised a dream that many Argentines hold on to, and there's reasons for it. He promised to make Argentina the European country that it was supposed to be. And in a country where, I mean, the natives were slaughtered, there's, you know, 5-10% left, and everybody else is of European descent, and the culture is to a large extent, at least in the capital is and down south, to a very large extent European. This was very appealing. You know, the architecture reflects it, the culture reflects it. So people, he won overwhelmingly. And he did. I mean, he did bring in foreign investment. But, of course, as usual, at what price? You know, there was all these malls and these new buildings and new cars showing up. But the social programs were being completely neglected. The debt was still growing. And what he became synonymous with was corruption. I forget the figure, but it's many, many, many millions of dollars that, you know, disappeared. And when we say corruption in Argentina, I think people often fail to grasp to what extent we're talking about it. It's not like in some countries where, you know, there's corruption, it's bad. No. They suck the life out of everything and every cent that comes by them. It all disappears. You know, there's been cases where, you know, there's been programs of milk to really poor neighborhoods and cities. And they steal the money from these things. I mean, they have no shame. But anyways, by the second term, very important. In order to cut down and to stop hyperinflation, Cavallo, the economy minister, imposed something called convertibility. What this did was it tied the peso to the dollar. And while it made Argentines be able to go abroad more and have more spending power, it killed, to a large extent, the export industry. It just became too expensive. It wasn't a good deal. What happened eventually was people just got really fed up of the corruption, the parties. By the parties, we mean just parties where all sorts of scandalous things happened that would make, you know, the Lewinsky scandals look really, you know, just not very important at all. And there was, again, elections. And the alliance, which was the radicals and a lot of smaller parties, ran a campaign which, if you put Communist Party of Argentina instead of alliance, nobody would have known the difference. It was all about, we're going to end the party for the few, we're going to build a juster Argentina, we're going to rebuild, you know, the healthcare industries, the social service nets. It was very much left-oriented. Of course, you know, they won. The radicals, as soon as they were in power, they were by far the largest party in the alliance. The alliance crumbled. De la Rúa just did anything he wanted, really. He had no regard for any of the parties. The vice president resigned. But most of all, he had said that he was going to build an Argentina for Argentines. It sounds, you know, very much right-wing and nationalist, but it was of the left-wing nationalism, in that it was going to be an Argentina and a government that responded to the interests of the people and not the multinationals and the foreign investors and whatnot. As soon as he was in power, again, he started talking about how we had to keep up our commitments to the IMF. We had to have economic plans that were sustainable in the eyes of the IMF. We had to impose austerity measures. He did something called the impuestazo, where he said there was going to be no more taxes. Of course, a fair amount of new taxes. And he declared that we would all have to tighten our belts because there was going to be austerity measures. Of course, when they say tighten our belts, they mean other people's belts, not theirs. What happened was there was a lot of slashing of workers, state workers' salaries. There was a lot of firings in all the municipalities. Basically anybody. I mean, for example, university professors. You'd think that university professors would be respected because they, you know, they have an important function in society. I met one during the protests whose salary had gone from $600 to just over $150 in 2 years. A university professor is making $150 a month, you know, it's unacceptable. But this obviously led to a lot of a response. The trade unions started declaring strikes. The unemployed started organizing themselves. And to some extent, even the middle classes started getting involved. But what happened, for example, the strikes. To understand why they didn't have the appeal that they should have had, we need to look at the Argentine syndicalist movement, which is, again, it's another example of the rampant corruption there is, where people have no faith whatsoever in the Argentine unions. I mean, they're run like mafias, and they're incredibly violent. It's dangerous. For example, if you're not with one of the big unions, it's physically dangerous to your health to try to organize workers in a particular sector. For example, there was a case not too long ago where they were trying to agitate for a new union in the railway, with railway workers. A union that responded to the interests of the workers rather than making deals with the bosses for the profit of the union leadership. There was some guy, he was giving out flyers, and he was, around where they worked every once in a while. They poisoned him and killed him. So, evidently, you think twice about doing workplace organizing in that kind of a context. So the strikes, they had the appeal, but it was the unionist scene and the leftists and, quote-unquote normal people just kept far from it. Then there was the unemployed movement that was doing road blockades and things of that sort. And that was more based in the neighborhoods and based in the communities. And it met very violent repression. One particular occasion, they were cutting off a bridge in some province, I forget which one, and the police just opened fire on them. They killed two people. But, I mean, the situation was getting progressively worse and worse. There's also 3 years, by this time, this is, 99, 2000, there's 3 years of recession. There's more and more unemployment. It reached 18.6%, which is, record. And that's nationwide. You went up north to some of the northern provinces, and it was sometimes up to like 50%. It was just, they were wrecked. There was no industry. There was nothing. And eventually, getting up to pretty much up to date in November, there began to be rumors that the banks were going to collapse. This, of course, led to rushes on the banks for people to get their money out. And this is early December now. And Cavallo, seeing what was happening and fearing that the banks would in fact collapse if everybody took their money, imposed something called the Corralito. The Corralito was meant to stop this, and what it did was it limited you to $250 from the bank per week. Not only this, but you weren't able to take more than $1,000, pesos, all the same thing, at least until recently. More than $1,000 out of the country with you. There was a limit on how much you could wire out of the country as well. And the intention of this was, a lot of the Argentine industry and economy is under the table, en negro, as they say in Spanish. By a lot, I mean, they estimate it's 40 to 50% of it. Just workers, they're not illegal, they just, they're never written anywhere, they don't pay taxes, they have no rights, the usual. So what they said was, by doing this, it would force people to open bank accounts, it would force them to use debit cards, checks, things of that sort, and hence it would force them to legalize a large part of the economy, which would in turn bring in more taxes, which would give the state more money, which would allow them to pay off the IMF debt, which last time I checked was $136 billion. What happened, though, I mean, as usual in Argentina, things aren't, I don't know if they're just, they don't care, or they're stupid. I honestly don't know what the problem is with the Argentine ruling. Why? There's many, but in this sense, what the problem is with the Argentine ruling class. Because, for example, they said that businesses, small middle-class businesses, would have to have debit, be able to take debit and credit cards and things like that in order to function. Okay, fair enough. Many countries function this way. However, the company that sells or rents out the debit card machines had 18,000 of these. They needed 400,000. So, that's over 350,000 businesses that have no way of getting money because people don't have cash to pay them with and they don't have the machines. So how are you supposed to survive? It was just ridiculous. And there was another very serious problem with this, was that the Argentine poor and working poor and unemployed, to a large extent, depend on the small change of those who are a little better off for their day-to-day living. They depend on, selling whatever it is at stoplights. They depend on, you know, just handouts and things of that sort. And with people not having cash in their pocket, they weren't getting that, you know, those few dollars that made them be able to survive on a day-to-day basis. So this all created two initially separate, but eventually they blended together, but two rebellions. And by this point, I mean, I was in Argentina already. And, you know, you started to sense it, but most of us were caught off guard by how strong it became. What happened was the middle class, Argentina's always had a very strong middle class, though. It's probably the strongest in Latin America, or at least it was. I'm sure Chile and Uruguay now is probably a little stronger. But so the middle class is an important factor in Argentina. And they started having street demonstrations in their neighborhoods and banging their pots and pans and closing their stores and things of this sort. And on the other hand, you had the Argentine poor that, you know, had no money, no food. And so they started congregating around the supermarkets and asking for food. And when they weren't given the food, they took the food. And this was the beginning of the looting. And it was, I remember when it started, it was very odd. I kind of missed most of it because I was trying to get tickets for a soccer game. But what's very odd, I mean, it seems irrelevant, but it is important. And there was 10,000 people. This was a championship game. 10,000 people lined up the night before. And soccer in Argentina is a very violent thing. There's usually many, many police officers there to make sure that we don't kill each other. And for some reason, there was none. And none of us understood very well why this was. And then, you know, rioting broke out in the line because there was desperation to get the tickets. And there was no police officers. Eventually, they sent two squad cars for 10,000 people. So I get home, and I'm not sleeping. I haven't been in this soccer thing. I turn on the TV at like 3 p.m. This is like the 19th of December, I believe. Yeah, the 19th. And there was fighting. Municipal workers had gotten into fights with the police in La Plata, which is an hour from Buenos Aires. More municipal workers had gotten into fights with police in Cordoba. The police had fired tear gas into a union local where there was children practicing for their ballet show that they had that night. This outraged the neighborhood. The whole neighborhood poured out and started fighting with the police. Now, it was obviously, there was tension, you know, but there always was. But it seemed like it was a little more. And so I went to bed, not having slept all night, and I woke up at like 11 p.m. I turned on the TV, and you know how they say that the revolution won't be televised? Well, it was. It really was. I turned on the television, and the whole country had exploded during these 8 hours that I had fallen asleep. I missed it all. Apparently, you know, there had been, the reason why the police weren't there at the soccer thing was because there was looting attempts at all the supermarkets in that neighborhood. Unemployed workers had cut off the accesses to the bridges that led into the neighborhood. And as the day progressed, you know, you heard of a looting here and a looting there and another one there and dozens, then hundreds, then thousands of people involved. And it grew and it grew and it came. In Buenos Aires, the poorer areas are around the capital, the suburbs. And the capital, I mean, the capital has all sorts and it also has very poor areas, but it's more diverse, whereas the outskirts tend to be generally worse off. But it went advancing, getting closer and closer to the city. And at 10 p.m., apparently what had happened was De La Rúa had given a speech, a four-minute speech, where I saw it later on. It became obvious just how out of touch these people were with the needs and concerns of the Argentine people. Here's a people who are, you know, sick of not having enough to eat, sick of not having jobs, sick of being robbed of the little money they do have. The ones that do have some money have just been told that they can't have access to it. There was, not only were these limits on how much you get from the bank, it would take you pretty much all day of standing in line to try to open a bank account. So people were very frustrated. And here's this president who gets up, speaks for 4 minutes, and says that the violence is regrettable, and that the agitators need to be stopped, and that in order to stop these agitators, he's declaring a state of emergency. Thank you very much. Good night. People were just outraged. It was, you know, really was the last straw. And, you know, they started banging on their pots. Because I remember when I woke up, I heard all this banging. And it's, what is, you know, what's going on? Is there a wedding? Is there a party? What? And people just went out on their balconies and started banging their pots and pans. Or they just went to the streets. Or they started, you know, honking. If they were in the cars, they started honking in their cars. And eventually what happened was, in most of the neighborhoods, hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, were congregating in front of the presidential residence. There was like 5,000 people. In front of Cavallo, the economy minister's residence, there was another 5,000. And this isn't where the economy minister lives. It's a very nice neighborhood. It's not, you know, a working class area. And even these people, you know, were taking to the streets, which is, you know, odd to see, like these, you know, old men and women all really well dressed and with jewelry in the middle of the street, blocking traffic, banging their pots and pans. But where there was the highest concentrations of people were in front of the presidential palace, the Plaza de Mayo, and in front of the Congress. There was probably, I don't know, 40, 50,000 people there. And, you know, this kept going for a few hours, and it seemed like nothing was happening. And eventually, at like 2 in the morning, for some reason, you know, some say they were attacked, some say they just got scared because there's so many people. The police just went mad. They went wild. And they started shooting with just anything. And, for example, the tear gas they were shooting at, the canister said expires 1983. It was straight from the military dictatorship. I mean, there was no doubt. Rubber bullet guns that shoot in a spray, kind of like rubber bullet shotguns. The other thing was, you know, Argentine police, you never know what they're shooting at you with. It's, in theory, supposed to be a rubber bullet, but you never know. And every once in a while, you know, they load it with the wrong bullet. But, you know, the fighting lasted all night. Some people tried to resist, others just ran away. Banks started to get smashed. By 6 or 7 in the morning, though, it died down. And then, again, I sat home. I missed it all. I'm embarrassed to say that I was at home watching it almost. But because you didn't know it was going to end in a second, and you had to travel there, and you really didn't know it was going to be worth the trip. But so I saw it all on TV, and at 6 or 7, something very odd started to happen. Some, you know, at the beginning, it was maybe 50 people who were incredibly brave, because, again, police brutality in Argentina is a very serious issue. I mean, you know, the U.S., it's very bad. It's one of the worst ones, at least in the, you know, so-called first world. But Argentina, it's a serious problem. When you get arrested, you're usually less worried about the charges than you are they going to kill me? But like 50 people went back in front of the presidential palace, and they sat down in front of these cops that had been, you know, beating everybody and shooting at everybody all night. And they just sat there. And I'm usually not a big fan at all of the corporate press and the mass media, but in this case, I think they were very much influential in the development of the struggle for the next few days, because they covered this live, and they covered these people saying, it's early now, but we hope that as people wake up, as they start going to work, that they'll come and be with us today at the plaza, and that we can again show them that it's too much and make them resign. And it happened, you know, 50 became 75, and 75, 100, and by around noon, there was a good 200 people. And again, what was interesting was it was all sorts. It was men, women, young, old. It was, you know, people who, you know, 18-year-old unemployed kids, suit and tie folks going on their way to work, stopping for a few minutes or on their lunch hour. And it, you know, it was really growing. And obviously, I think this scared, you know, the police again. And so they gave orders around noonish, I would say, to cleanse the plaza. That was the exact terms. And to this, you had added that there had been a left-wing demonstration called for, which was going to go from the Congress to the presidential palace against the state of emergency. Because the last time there was any sort of serious state of emergency declared, you know, 30,000 people died. So, you know, it was a scary thought. And there was talk of the military coming in to resolve the situation. And, you know, as soon as I heard that, I said, okay, tickets for 2 weeks from now. You you know, sit home and watch TV for 2 weeks, we should be okay. And I didn't even live through that period. I don't even want to imagine what those who did must have been thinking, you know? But despite all that, a good 3,000-4,000 people showed up at this leftist march. And as I was leaving, around 1 maybe, the police began attacking the people at the plaza on horseback. And another thing they'll do is they'll ride in on motorcycles with two to a motorcycle, and one drives while the other swings the baton or shoots the... So you really can't get away from them. You're not going to outrun the motorcycle, and you know it can go anywhere. And it was a massacre. You know, it was only 200 people, and it was very brutal. I think the first death of the day was there. Somebody got shot with a rubber bullet in the neck, and you know, that was it. But you know, as I was leaving, I kept saying, "Okay, it's over," and I would start leaving, and all of a sudden, the Plaza de Mayo set up with diagonal streets that lead into it. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, groups of 100, 200, 300 would rush back in and then be dispersed again and rush back in. So, I kept trying to get to the door and I couldn't make it. But, you know, eventually they got dispersed. I left and I got to the left wing demo. And from here, it's all a personal account because I wasn't following the news. You know, I only know what I saw and the little that was, well, not the little, but what was in the newspapers the next day, which most of it isn't very trustworthy, just comparing it to what I saw and what they said. The demonstration began. There was the whole alphabet soup of Argentine leftists. And by alphabet soup, I mean, really, there's splits of splits of splits of splits. You know, I think they feel compelled when they reach 10 members to have a split. It's like tradition. Which, it's very sad, you know, because there's a fair amount of you know, left-wing activity in Argentina. But it's just so fractured that they can never really get it together. And another thing, when I lived in Argentina, I wasn't very close to the anarchists because there's a lot of, and I know it's a buzzword and people resent the term, but there's a lot of what I deem to be lifestyleism. They weren't involved in the struggles that were important to the people in Argentina. They had almost fundamentalist attitudes. For example, they would say, "Oh well, we're not going to this demonstration or this action because such and such party, leftist party, not you know some horrible fascist, such and such Marxist group will be there, and so we're not going to go." I don't feel that's the way to do things. You should go and put forward your alternative. But if you don't go, then you're just leaving the terrain wide open for these people. And so it didn't seem to be worth my time. So I drifted to the Argentine Communist Party. And I had gone to a lot of demos with them. And what was always kind of under the surface was this general sense of defeat. These are people who were very much demoralized. You know, many of them had many comrades who died. Many of them, you know, thought that they were going to make a revolution in Argentina and then were crushed. And it's never, you know, they almost looked like drones. They had no energy. But at this demonstration, there was this spirit in the air of, you know, something's changing. And all these groups were, the chants, I mean, they were next to delirious, I would say, in hindsight. But they were chanting things like, "In Argentina, we can make the revolution with all the left united." Or they will see when we take over power, you know, what's going to happen to them. And all the chants revolved around, "We're going to take over power and we're going to do it today." You know, which I thought was a little, you know, a little out there, but whatever, it makes you happy. And they started marching. 2 blocks down, gas was flying, bullets, you know, the slingshots were out, poles, benches were being dragged out in the street to make barricades. Anything, you know, the banks were being destroyed. Anything that could be unhinged from the banks was dragged into the street. I mean, anything you could possibly imagine. And there was maybe 1 hour of fighting there. But eventually it was decided that this was a bad idea, as it was just the 3,000 or 4,000 leftists. And nobody will think twice in Argentina about massacring some leftists. It's just not a big deal. So it was decided that we should try to head over to where everybody else was. So we took another route towards the presidential palace. And the journey was pretty calm. I mean, some banks got smashed. Some people cheered. Others booed. Nobody really thought much about it. And as we're getting closer, we see these huge clouds of black smoke, like everywhere, pretty much. And we get to, I don't know, 5 blocks away, and there was a battle. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I can't give a good estimate of how many people were there, because there was many diagonal streets, and it looked like on every one there was the exact same battle going on. But I'm sure it's in the 20, 30,000 people range. And what was incredible is that for once, it was the police retreating and not the demonstrators. And it was, I mean, and again, you know, people here generally when they fight the police, they have, you know, gas masks and shields and padding and helmets. No, this is people with T-shirts and shorts, and that was the extent of the protection. And anyways, and despite this, you know, the gas, you couldn't see through the gas. And the bullets, there had already been three or four dead by this point. And you never knew what they were shooting at you with, but people still went forward anyways. And if they retreated, it was with the clear intention of taking a two-minute break and going back again. And again, it was young, old men, women, you know, poor, not so poor, people in suits and ties. You know, store owners would open their doors and let you in, give you water, let you have a rest, and then, you know, send you on your way again. And the spirit, for example, I remember one point we were sitting against a wall and, you know, taking a break. There was a lot of gas, couldn't breathe anymore, needed a break. And this couple was like 60, 70 years old, at least, with bandanas over their face, starts yelling at us because we're sitting down. And, you know, and I had a tough time trying to explain to this person that, you know, we're just taking a break. It's been many hours. We're very tired. You know, that was the spirit that there was to it. It was incredible. And sure enough, we were going forward, and the barricades were being pushed forward, and every side street was barricaded so that they wouldn't be able to cut anybody off. And after, you know, but it was meter by meter, yard by yard, whatever you want to call it. And it took us, I think, 4 hours to advance three blocks. But sure enough, we had gotten to the corner of the plaza that leads to the presidential palace. And we had this huge barricade. And what was incredible was, I like to think my anarchism is strong. I've had it for many years. But there was this atmosphere of, we're going to get into the presidential palace, and once we're in there, nothing will, or anybody will ever get us out. And that'll be the end of it. We're just going to, you know, raise the red flag and do things right, and that's it. You know, it was probably mass, you know, delusion. But we believed it, and many, many people believed it. And I think that's why people kept going forward, and it didn't seem to affect them that there was, you know, all this gas and bullets and whatnot. And even I, an anarchist, said, yeah, it sounds logical. And this is not a plan for revolution. We're going to take over the presidential palace and then just not leave. You know, no. It's not how you do things. But, you know, that's what we thought. And, you know, eventually, obviously, the police made, I think it was their last stand. I really do. And I think had that failed, I don't know what would have happened. Probably just a lot more dead. We might have gotten in there and they probably would have just killed us all. So, you know, it's probably a good thing that we didn't get in there. But eventually they started shooting, I mean, 30, 40, 50 gas canisters at a time. And it sounded like machine gun fire almost. It just never stopped, the bullets. And that, you know, that pushed us back. And again, it was very hard to disperse everybody because everybody knew where we were going. Normally when you have a demonstration, the police disperses, you don't know how to find. Everybody knew what the target was, and, you know, the streets are all diagonal. And so it was very difficult for the police to disperse us. And eventually they tried riding in with the bikes again. But again, I saw something that was just incredible, definitely a first for me. The motorcycle delivery boys, and women, but it's mainly men, had gotten on their motorcycles and come downtown, and they were all masked up and everything, and they were doing the impossible to harass the cops. You know, I'm not a motorcycle driver, but I wouldn't drive my motorcycle up to police with guns and drive around them and harass them and make their lives difficult. No, not something I do. But they did, and two of them died for it, you know. But it was just incredible to what extent people were willing to go. And people were fed up. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like at the other big demos that we, you know, many of us have been at, where people come and some of them are militant, some aren't, and, you know, they're upset. But it's a different thing. This is, you know, this was the city, the people. There was no other way around it. And I think that's the biggest media lie that I've heard so far regarding this whole fight. Was they said, oh yeah, the first day was, you know, the good people of Argentina and the middle classes and whatnot. But the second day was all the activists and, you know, the usual violent ones. I'm sorry, not true. Sure, we were there, and we were 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, I don't know how many. but there was at least 30,000 people there. And I know that, for example, I'm used to, by instinct, when I see somebody with a bandana around their face and a rock in their hand, I assume there's some sort of leftist, if there were a demonstration that I'm at, you know? I assume there's some sort of leftist, and to some extent my comrade, and so I would go up to these people and say, you know, we'd start talking or whatever, and, you know, I'd say something about the party or this or that or the other, and they'd look at me like, what party? What are you talking about? And it became clear that a lot of these were just kids, you know, 18 to 25, and they were saying things like, I've never been in politics before in my life, but I'm sick of not having a job, I'm sick of not having money, I'm sick of being exploited at my job, and I'm sick of them stealing our money, and so enough is enough, and that's why I'm here. And, you know, the old people and the ones in suits and ties, they're not activists. It's just not true. And this lie, I mean, it's bothersome to begin with, but it serves a purpose. And the purpose is to try to say, oh, normal people are, you know, peaceful, and they, when, you know, trouble starts, they leave. But, you know, those who, you know, fight and want to go further, they're, you know, the extremists and the activists and the radicals. Because, you know, they don't want normal people to think that you can, you know, take matters into your own hands. But, I don't know, I think not too many people bought that lie, because it was too blatant, you know? There just isn't 50,000 of us, it's that simple. But anyway, sooner or later, we began to be dispersed a lot. And what happened here is you started seeing the looting again. And, I mean, corporations, whatnot, you know, I'm not going to shed a tear if people loot them and break them and set fire to them, you know? I don't care. But the thing was, I mean, at some points it was inspiring, and at other points it was depressing, because, all right, a detail, and I forget it because it really was a detail during the day. The president resigned somewhere in the middle of this, but nobody seemed to care, because I think that's where I saw how much, like, how ripe the Argentine working class, and even middle class to some extent, is for anarchist organizing in Argentina, because people would say things like, so what if the president resigned? He's just a puppet, the system's the problem. Or, it doesn't matter, we need to take things into our own hands, we need to go back into our communities and organize there so that they can't do these things with us. Honestly, there's many, many more examples that I'm sure I'm forgetting. But, you know, everybody I spoke to was saying things that we could have signed your local anarchist and nobody would have known the difference. Of course, when you said, I'm your local anarchist, the face has changed a little. But, you know, the idea was still there. But back to the looting. This is the first time there was mass looting that wasn't mainly of food places. And it was inspiring, as I said, because, you know, here's people who had for much of their life not had anything or had very little. And this is right before Christmas time, which is very important in Argentina. And, you know, just taking what they needed and what they wanted to make at least, you know, the next few days or weeks of their lives a little better. So again, all the better for them. I'm not going to shed any tears. But there also was just the random looting of anything that could be looted. And, for example, you know, there's a lot of immigrants in Argentina, because in South America, you know, if you're from Peru, Bolivia, Paraguay, you go to Argentina, just like people come to the U.S. You know, Argentina is where you went, especially with the dollar and the peso being tied. You earned not so much in Argentina, you went back to your country and you lived very well. And these people, you know, sometimes they save up money and they manage to start their own, you know, very small businesses, which are their only livelihood. And also, there's a fair amount of immigration from Korea and Taiwan. And, for example, there was a Korean business, a very small market, that just got destroyed. And, you know, the guy was on TV just crying, bawling. I mean, he couldn't speak. He was really, you know, beside himself. And, you know, he committed suicide the next day. And I think he and his wife committed suicide. Because, you know, they said this was our only livelihood, and we worked for many, many years, and now it's gone. And so that was sad to see, because it was a battle of, you know, dirt poor versus, you know, not so dirt poor. But I don't know. There was moments that were just very much surreal. At one point, I was sitting on the sidewalk in front of this candy store, and I was sitting there talking to this woman who was a university professor who was telling me about her wage had been cut. And again, this is a 55-year-old university professor in the middle of the rioting. You know, it was that kind of atmosphere. And all of a sudden I hear, you know, boom, crash, bang, but you didn't give much second thought to it because it was like white noise by that point. But I look in front and the candy store is being looted. And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, candy is flying into my lap. Very much literally. I was sitting, like, as I am now, and I would just go and catch it and eat it. And it was nice to see also, because the greed, these are people, again, who've never had anything. But the one moment where there was enough to go around, the greed factor disappeared. It was incredible. I mean, people were going, you know, would you like some chocolate? Would you like some candy? Merry Christmas. Seriously, a man came up to the professor that was next to me and gave her a chocolate cake, like this big and this fat, and said, Merry Christmas, there you go. And, you know, it was just incredible. People were giving it out and sharing them, and you know, it was very nice to see. And another lady that was sitting next to me said something to the effect of, you know, candy's falling from the sky. If this isn't a sign that better days will come, then what is, you know? So that was nice. But, you know, eventually we were pushed back more, and, you know, there was more looting of, you know, anything you can possibly imagine. But eventually most of the organized groups decided to start leaving, and it was really getting dispersed. And I decided to leave as well because, since demonstrations tend to be dangerous in Argentina, most groups organize blocks. Just like here, you know, the black block, and it's, you know, it's very much a controversial thing to organize a block and form lines and have things to protect yourself with. There, it's just a basic. It's given that each party, you know, and each group has its block, its contingent, and that if trouble starts, you know, you close it and you don't let too many people you don't know into it and all that. So I had been with the Communist Party most of the time because I knew some of them, and that would, you know, so it was a safety guarantee. But with them leaving, it was just kind of, you know, a free-for-all, and I didn't feel very safe at it. And plus there was, I mean, as there is always with these big things, there were some not-so-clear elements in them. There were some far-right, I'm sure. You know, there was a couple people I spoke to that all of a sudden I said, hey, if this was any other time, you and me would be hitting each other very hard. You know, but you just couldn't, because nobody would understand it. But, so I decided to leave. And it pretty much died down. And you know, I began to start, and I thought it was over, because the next day nothing much happened. And I thought it was over, and I started to, you know, analyze and see what lessons we could draw from this, particularly as anarchists. But I remember that when I wrote the article that I wrote about what I thought and what I'd seen and whatnot, I concluded by saying that I thought that, you know, it was a revolution made halfway. Because we created a vacuum of power that we couldn't fill. The left couldn't fill it with authoritarian, you know, with themselves in power, and the anarchists couldn't fill it with, you know, putting forward the alternative the people could take as their own. And the only party that was left that could fill it was the Peronists, which everybody hated as much as the radicals. And that was very clear in the streets, too, that it wasn't just against the government. It was against the political ruling class. Which, and again, the Argentine political class has done more, I think, to further anarchism than a million rabid anarchists could ever do. Because they haven't left any betrayal or lie to be said or done. They just haven't. They've done them all. But I said that, you know, the people had been demobilized because it had been a few days. It was, you know, it seemed like it was over. And generally, once these things die down, it takes a while for them to start up again. So it was depressing. You know, it was demoralizing to think of. And then all of a sudden, you know, 5 days, 1 week later, I forget how much time later. The 26th, about a week later. One person who people didn't like because he had a history of corruption and whatnot was named to be on the new cabinet. And people went crazy again. And again, all the neighborhoods and in front of the presidential palace and the Congress and thousands and thousands. And he was forced to resign. And I guess what happened was, and as we get closer to what's going on now, I think it becomes even more obvious, was I think the people really noticed that, hey, you know, we have a lot of power when we're in the streets and there's a lot of us and we have some sort of a plan. And, you know, they got a taste of that power, and I don't think they're willing to be led, you know, bossed around and lied to anymore. Because now it seems like every 2 days somebody does something that people deem unacceptable and all of Argentina looks like it's going to erupt again. But, and, you know, the rioting started again, and he was forced to resign. And then there was another president, and he resigned. And I think I lost track, but by the time I left, we had 5 presidents. So, you know, that'd be 20 years of an American life. But I don't know. I mean, the lessons, I think, to be drawn are very important. I think, as anarchists, like I said, the anarchist movement in Argentina, I think, to a large extent, I don't even like to call it a movement. It's more a scene. But there is a tendency within it that I have a lot of respect for, that I see very much eye to eye with. It is essentially, politically, it is the same as NEFAC in Argentina. It's called the OSL, which means Libertarian Socialist Organization. And they do very serious, very disciplined, and committed work. What they do is they have, and this is, I think, something that American anarchists, or anarchists in the U.S. should look at also, is that oftentimes anarchists say, oh, we want to break out of the ghetto, we want to, you know, go work in the popular organizations, the neighborhood organizations and whatnot, but they do so as individuals. And what ends up happening is they don't have any sort of coherent plan behind them, any sort of alternative proposal to put forth. And so they get lost in the sea of, you know, reformist politics and whatnot, and they end up being the people who do the grunt work for the reformers. What the OSL does is it serves as kind of the organizing pole from which anarchists then go out into their neighborhoods and into their workplaces and whatnot and organize and put forward this alternative, and they're involved in the struggles, and, you know, they gain trust because they are on the front lines after all. And but they always can go back to the organization, the meetings, and they put forward a coherent and viable alternative as a movement, not just as, oh, you know, the crazy one who happens to work with us and, you know, he's nice or she's nice and we'll leave him there because he's nice. They put forward an alternative. And they're growing like this. I mean, they're still insignificantly small, but it's, you know, it's serious political organizing, and it's serious work that's done, you know, door to door, street by street, neighborhood by neighborhood. So it's very slow. But they are growing. And they're growing, I think, where it's most important to grow, which is amongst the most disenfranchised and just, you know, the poorest of Argentina. Because after all, I mean, that is the sector that has the least to lose, and that is the sector that has the most reason to be upset. So, I mean, I think that's an important lesson that we should draw from, because we've done it a lot, even in Europe and the U.S. with the anti-globalization movement. A lot of the political space, this is more so true in Europe, a lot of the political space that we as anarchists opened up by being more militant and by being, you know, having more extreme, quote-unquote, reivindications, we opened up this political space. We made it okay to say certain things and argue for certain things. And there was a large enough movement behind it that governments have had to say, maybe we're going to have to, you know, concede a little. But we weren't ready. We weren't organized as a movement to be the ones that fill that political space. Again, not as authoritarians and not with, you know, hierarchical structures, but to put forward a viable alternative that people can then take as their own and fill that space with an alternative that's, you know, decentralized, self-managed, you know, et cetera, the usual. What happened was, like, in France, the government is now negotiating with ATTAC. And ATTAC, to me, is scum. They're opportunists, authoritarians, reformists, and they're the ones who are taking advantage of the political space and the grunt work and the arrests and the injuries and the whatnot that many, you know, anarchists and other revolutionaries in Europe have been doing and suffering for, you know, many, many years. So I think that's something we need to very seriously look at to be able to, because, you know, I think something that another anarchist I was talking to down there said, which is very much right, you know, hunger and misery don't make revolutions. You know, they're good ingredients and they make people upset, but they can be very bad combinations if you don't have the infrastructure to fill, you know, to fill the spaces that creates. And right now I don't think we have them. The other issue I think of importance would be syndicalism, the union question, because when you say that I as an anarchist believe that we need to organize in the neighborhoods and in the workplaces. But again, Argentina is an extreme example, but I think the case is true everywhere that, you know, the reformist unions do not really represent the interests of the workers. And furthermore, they're damaging in that they take energy and they take motivation and they take impulse, let's say, away from the struggles of the working class. And I think we need to eat away at that, and we need to eat away at them by doing serious workplace organizing that bases itself around trying to organize workers, but also eating, just like we try to build dual power, you know, in the communities by, you know, having community projects and undermining the power of the state. I think we should apply that to the workplaces where we try to undermine the power of the mainstream unions, because, you know, they are the ones that, to a large extent, I'm fairly certain that there's a lot of people involved in the struggles against globalization that are involved in them through the unions that didn't want to call off everything in the post-September 11th period, you know? But that structure, that framework, stops them and cuts them off. Or in Europe, where they'll go to the mass mobilizations, but they'll drag them out a day before anything actually starts. Or, I mean, there's so many examples, but I think it's important that we look at that as well. That when we do workplace organizing, it shouldn't just be as anarchists trying to foment, put forward our perspective. It should be consciously and actively working to undermine the mainstream unions, because I do feel they're very dangerous. Maybe this is because the Argentine example is so extreme, but I do feel they're very dangerous.
I don't know if you mentioned this, but I was reading on the newspaper, even like mainstream newspapers in Argentina, like Clarín and stuff, and they were talking about community assemblies that were started after the riots, and I thought it was a very, very cool thing, because you see the TV, or you see the picture on the internet, like gatherings of people outside of the park, like, you know, hundreds of people just talking about different things in the communities. And I don't know if you went to one of these, or
Yes, I remember a few days into these things, I started seeing banners saying popular neighborhood general assembly, you know, such and such neighborhood, you know, Friday, 3 p.m. and whatnot. And I didn't get to go to any, because I just didn't have a chance to, and most of them were in other neighborhoods, were pretty far. But what I saw on TV, and from what I've read on like indie media and just emails from friends and things, they are, you know, getting to be pretty large, and they are multiplying themselves, and they're talking about building a federation of community general assemblies. If this isn't anarchism, I don't know what is, you know. There's no elected officials. Everything is done through voting, and it's decentralized. I mean, it's incredible. It really is incredible. They do seem to be multiplying. And another thing that I forgot also is, I think tomorrow is going to be a very big day in Argentina. At least that's what it looks like from reading the papers. I spoke to my father today, who's in Argentina. I forgot to ask him, unfortunately. But apparently there's mass protests of unemployed, leftists, and the middle class. Again, I'm usually not a big fan of... I feel the middle class is, you know, some of them, when the time comes, some of them will side with the ruling class, some will side with the workers, but either way, I didn't concern myself too much with it. But in Argentina, I mean, I think they are influential, and if this demonstration is as large as they're talking, if these protests are as large as they're saying they're going to be, they're saying it's the leftists, the middle class, and the unemployed, that could topple the government. And I mean, from when I left 2-3 weeks ago till now, I've been following it, you know, from the papers and whatnot. And there's still demos every day and rioting, and the banks are being attacked. And, you know, people know what's going on. They're very clearly, you know, attacking. For example, the banks have become public enemy number one, which is always nice for me. Personally, it's something that's very nice to see. Like, nobody in Argentina now will complain if somebody throws a rock through a bank window. Nobody. Except maybe the manager. But, and another thing that anarchists have been doing, which is, I think, very, very good and a great way to build links with people, is that, like I said, there's lines outside of the banks that are blocks long, and people spend hours. And another thing is, for example, the retirees are having trouble getting their money from the bank. And these are, I mean, it's very sad to see. It's people who've worked all their lives. They've saved up, you know, a little money so they could be more comfortable when they retire, and now they can't get it from the bank. And they have to stand outside all day, and it's, you know, 100 degrees. And what OSL people have been doing is being at these lines, giving people water, saying, would you like me to get you something? And just talking with them and giving them, you know, flyers and propaganda and whatnot. And from what I've heard from people I spoke to is that the reception has been great. I mean, even on the most basic level is, you know, you evidently clear up the, I thought anarchists just like to break things, misconception, you know, that falls pretty quickly. And, you know, people say, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, they talk about the General Assemblies and how people should go to the General Assemblies. And they said, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. So, I mean, it really, I don't know. I mean, we have such a history of defeat that I try not to get too excited about it because, you know, be less depressed if we fail. But it really is exciting to see and just to watch it develop. And I wish I was still there, I guess.
Two quick questions. One is like the way I was reading about it was as a general strike that brought down the president.
No.
And if it, okay, then never mind
that. I'll answer it.
What was the if it was people going on strike? What was the relationship with the unions and other stuff like that? And third, what about or second, what about in the countryside? Were people doing stuff miles and miles from the big cities?
There was. It was obviously not as large. Argentina, to a large extent, is two countries, if not more. There's Buenos Aires, which is a third of the country. It's about 13 million there. And the rest of the country. There was, but less so. But no, another important thing about the unions. It was very clear to what extent people dislike the mainstream unions. Because one of the chants that you heard a lot was, where are they? Obviously, it goes better in Spanish, but where are they? How come we can't see them, the famous syndicalists? And where are the unions, is essentially what they were saying. And it wasn't as if, oh, I wish they were here. It was more, the tone was, you know, we don't need them. And it's sad because I consider myself, you know, an anarcho-syndicalist mainly. I can't say the word syndicalism because people associate it with corruption and, you know, everything I stated before. And, you know, Argentina has a strong history of revolutionary unionism. The anarcho-syndicalist union, the FORA, at one point had 200,000 members. It was the largest in Latin America. And that history has just been erased. I mean, they still exist, but, you know, honestly, it's 10 people and they're all, you know, it's like a book club. They're, you know, they have no presence. They don't exist. So that was sad to see. But yeah, no, the unions were definitely nowhere to be found.
If I may comment, one of the other things I was watching on TV is that people were, like, it was mostly directed at the Partido Socialista, which is the Peronist Party that took over right now. But basically what people were saying is that we don't want these crooks. We don't want these politicians in power anymore. And they weren't just talking about the Radicales or the Alianza and the Justicialistas. It's just anybody in power, in a position of power over them. What they were saying is that we want these things to be decided by ourselves. And it was people who weren't like militant or activists or anything. It was also like middle class people who were just fed up, and they said, you know what, we're going to take it into our own hands. So they weren't calling for like a vanguard party or some sort of like, you know, elite group to guide them through these things. And I mean, this is people who were there and people who are suffering from all these things. And if they're saying it, I tend to agree more with the people who are suffering and who are living these things than with, you know, some sort of political party in Boston or something.
If I may add also, what was interesting to see was that for all the rhetoric, there was, I mean, I think the left, the Argentine Marxist left, will grow because of this, because they were there, and they were the only, I mean, besides Argentine flags, you saw only red flags, the occasional black one. You saw mainly red flags. And people in Argentina, I mean, there's a strong, you know, street, you know, fighting culture. And people respect, you know, I heard that a lot, you know. I'm not a big fan of the leftists generally, but, you know, they're out here, you know, they're the only flags we see up there. So it will keep growing, I think. But, I mean, there also was this, I mean, for all the talk about taking power in the revolution, a fair amount of the parties you saw, you know, waving flags two blocks behind. And that was just shameful. And, one of them had a Fourth International banner, which I believe is you folks. So, you know what, if that's how you, you know, take power and how you support the people, Christ, I wouldn't walk out of the next demonstration in Argentina because that was really bad.
I know in Germany in 1919, they also had, you know, workers' councils, popular assemblies, and many of them elected themselves out of existence in favor of, you know, of bourgeois democracy. And I was curious how involved and how committed are people to these assemblies? Do they see them as the alternative, or are they just a means to an end?
I honestly, I can't say definitely because I left as they were starting to really become big and become widespread. But I think it has the potential to become what people want for in the future, because they're saying, the message is clear. The message is, we're sick of the political ruling class, we're sick of the system we have, we want to take affairs into our own hands, and we want to build our communities and, you know, make them better ourselves. So I think to achieve those goals, you're not going to, you know, vote yourself into the party system. And it's, in terms of people, I mean, they're held on, you know, street corners and plazas, and apparently they're getting into the hundreds, and it's not activists, you know, it's people who are just fed up. So I'm hopeful for them. I'm not really that sure that it'll go away. First of all, because, I mean, Duale still made it very clear that he intends to pay the debt and whatnot, and that, you know, that's very important. And the debt is, to a large extent, the reason why the Argentine government is, you know, in the trouble it is, the debt and the corruption. But another thing is, everybody knows who Duale is in Argentina. He used to be the governor of the province of Buenos Aires, the outskirts. Left him dry, bankrupt, essentially. So, stolen, yeah, bazillion dollars, I'm sure. He's very much associated with the cocaine business. He used to be at one time synonymous with cocaine. I'm sure he's moved on to, you know, better things now, but it doesn't change the fact. And he is essentially a mobster. Like, the day he was being sworn in, like 500 leftists went to the Congress to, you know, to denounce him and keep saying this wasn't what the people were asking for. And they were attacked by like 2,000 dualists. And I can guarantee you that most of them were paid. They're not there because, you know, they feel that strongly. It's common in Argentina. You just pay people to go to demonstrations. As he was being sworn in, people started to assemble in front of the presidential palace. And apparently what happened was the big dudes, Duale's big boys, showed up and said, leave or we'll break your neck. So people know, I mean, people don't trust him. And yeah, I mean, the dying down thing, it could happen. And just like Perón is, you know, a hero in Argentina now because people lived well, even though they lived well because he, you know, emptied out all the money that the country had. It could happen. It's a risk. I mean, but the way to just try to stop it from happening, I think, is a constant agitation around the fact that they'll always bring us back to the same thing. They've done it for decades and decades. There's no reason to change. Look what you accomplished, you know, when you took the power into your own hands. Look what you accomplished in your neighborhoods, you know. There's already, like, a couple of neighborhoods where they have mutual aid programs where they're helping, like, they get money for the unemployed ones and they give them money for their families and whatnot. So I think we can make a clear case based on not just theory but also example and fact as to how your lives are better, you know, if you take them into your own hands rather than into the hands of these people, you know, done what they've been doing to you for God knows how many years.
That was a view of the December uprising in Argentina from Nicholas, an Argentinian expatriate who spoke last week in Boston.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. By unwelcome travelers.